The title for my talk this evening is The Meaning of It All. And as that suggests, this will be a little bit different than the usual Dharma talk, I think. What I'd like to do is share some of my reflections about, well, I guess the meaning of it all, starting with the first point that actually it's interesting once you start looking at the meaning of meaning, it means so many different things, right? Sometimes when we look for meaning, it's like the meaning of a word. Well, that's looking for a definition. But the meaning of a gesture or a look, well, that might be looking for the intention or the motivation behind it. But actually, it's a different kind of meaning that I want to talk about this evening. The meaning of it all really refers to, you know, looking for understanding about what's really important. So asking about the meaning of my life, for example, would be asking, you know, what's really important about my life? Or if we say the meaning of life in general, what's important about that? Which is important, I think, to clarify, because, you know, that's really going to help us decide, what should I do with my life? What should I devote myself to? And often that, you know, if we're going to ask about the meaning of my life, that also presupposes, I think, some connection outside ourselves. In other words, linking or harmonizing the meaning of my life with the meaning of the world, what's important about the world, about the universe, and therefore that can help us understand how to live in it. To say something meaningful about the meaning of it all, I think we need to begin by asking, where does meaning come from? What I mean by that is meaning something objective outside ourselves, external? For example, like many of you, I suppose, I was raised as a Christian, and that involved accepting a pretty complicated story, an objective story, right? A story about the way things really are. A pretty objective story about an all-knowing, all-loving, all-loving, all-powerful God who created everything. We humans last, and we're kind of special. We're made in the image of that God. But then we disobeyed the God. Adam and Eve disobeyed the God. We got kicked out of the garden. And later, we also did bad things that caused God to send a great flood that killed most human beings and, I guess, other animals as well. But eventually, God sent his only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, and if we believe in Jesus, if we accept him as our Savior, then that's really important because it means that it'll have great significance for what happens after we die in terms of whether we will go to heaven or spend an eternity in hell. Anyway, it's a fairly complicated story, but the basic idea was, you know, this is the way things are. This is a worldview about what's really happening in the world and what's important about the world. And a very important part of this story is that we believe in it, right? That if you want to be saved, if you want to go to heaven, it's really important to believe that Jesus Christ is your Savior. Nonetheless, sometime during my teenage years, and I expect I'm not the only one here, right? But sometime during my teenage years, I sort of couldn't believe in that story anymore, right? It just didn't make enough sense to me. It didn't fit in well enough into sort of the 20th century, what we know sort of scientifically about the way the world is. So I kind of lost interest in it. And I expect, as I said, that that's also been the experience of many of you as well. Now, of course, calling it a story doesn't in itself imply whether or not it's true or false, whether or not it actually corresponds to the way things that really are. But it is worth noting that one characteristic of, I think, us as human beings is that we do need a story to make some sense of the world, to make some sense of what the world is and who we are within it and how we should act within it, right? And the point is, it gets very tricky because the story can reflect what's true, but it can also be a projection, right? We can make up a story and then project it and understand the world in that way. And when we do that, of course, we also, if that's what we're doing, it's interesting that we become constrained by our own creation, right? We have this story, and then we think that's the way things are, and it may or may not be the case, but in either case, it does, in a way, constrain or trap us within the possibilities envisioned by that story. Like, you have to act in a certain way for the Christian story, right? If you don't act in the way that God wants you to act, well, that's really bad, because after you die, you're likely to suffer bad consequences. You're likely to be sent to eternal damnation rather than go to heaven. So I guess what I'm trying to point out here is that the story, in one way, it's necessary, but it also constrains us. Some such story is necessary. And the other thing in particular to note here with the Christian story, and indeed just about all of the big religious stories, one of the reasons they are so powerful and important is that they address our fear of death, usually by denying it in some way. So for example, for the Christian, the body may die, but we have a soul, and the soul is going to continue. But the important point here, I think, is that that is one of the reasons why these kinds of stories are so powerful, because the reality, of course, is that we know we are going to die someday, but most of us don't look forward to that, or that's not something that most of us are afraid of it. And so if you have a story that, you know, reassures you, you don't really die, well, there's something very attractive about that, and maybe that much harder to let go of, right? But anyway, I think whether or not you were raised a Christian, it's unlikely that that's the story that sort of seems really important to you. But what about the Buddhist worldview? Again, it's a very complicated story when you look at it. I mean, according to the sort of details, the Buddha, we're told, was not the first one. He was like the sixth in a series of Buddhas that appear when they are needed. And he himself had been reborn many times, sort of purifying his karma until he was able to finally wake up. And this story distinguishes very strongly this world of samsara, that is to say suffering, but not only suffering, the world of delusion, the world of craving. It distinguishes that from this other reality, nirvana, which the story doesn't, it's interesting in some ways, the Buddhist story doesn't really give us many specifics about the nature of that nirvana, but definitely there's a solution here that involves transcending this world of samsara, right? And there's also the story that in the future there will be another Buddha, Maitreya, who will come, and so forth. Now, here's a big question, I think, for many of us. If we are to be good Buddhists, do we need to accept all of this story? Or how much of this story do we need to accept? And I think this becomes a really big issue because, again, when we look at the Buddhist story in contemporary terms, one interesting thing is I think there's a lot in the Buddhist story that is compatible with the modern world as you know it. The emphasis on interdependence, the emphasis on how language thinking can mislead us, and also the understanding of the sense of self as a, you know, kind of psychological and social construct that develops. It's not something that we're born with. It's a way of experiencing that is constructed and therefore can be deconstructed and reconstructed, which is what the Buddhist path is about. So the question is, again, just as it was for the Christianity, is this story, does it actually reflect what is the case, or is it perhaps a story that applies at the time of the Buddha, but maybe there are important aspects of it that don't seem so relevant to our situation today, right? The earliest Buddhist text we have, the Pali Canon, it wasn't written down for about 300 years. And so it's really hard to get a sense of how accurate it is. For example, most Buddhist scholars would say, we really know nothing for sure about the life of the Buddha. It's too long. It's hard to say what's been mythologized and what hasn't been, right? So it's important to realize in Buddhism, the claim is that the Buddha experienced all these things. But again, we don't know. We don't know what to believe a lot of times in the modern world. And that's a problem. Or is it a problem? How important is belief in these doctrines in Buddhism? In fact, how important is belief in Buddhism generally? Because it's interesting, unlike Christianity, where belief is a very important part of the salvation, right? In Buddhism, belief doesn't really help you very much, like with your karma or with your awakening and so forth. It doesn't help you very much if you don't practice, right? In fact, if you think about meditation, isn't meditation actually letting go of all of our stories about ourselves, about our ego, about our relations to other people, and even what about stories about Buddhism, right? If meditation is about letting go of stories, what does that imply about the Buddha's story? And it's interesting that according to the Pali Canon, the Buddha himself refused to answer certain questions, such as, is the world eternal or infinite? Is the self identical with the body? Does the Buddha exist after death? Very interesting, very suggestive, this refusal, right? It's like the Buddha wasn't interested in pursuing or teaching that kind of story. Is it because it wasn't important? Maybe it was a distraction from the path that he was offering. Maybe at the heart or the essence of Buddhism is just enough of a story to direct us, to help us let go of stories so that we can what? So that we can experience the world and ourselves in the world in a different way. Of course, the world we live in today, the modern world, involves a lot of loss of, or at least deep questioning of a lot of the traditional religious teachings, right? I mean, you think about, say, Copernicus and how he decentered us according to early Christianity and that whole medieval worldview. We were the center of the universe, and now we realize we're a small planet around a star pretty far from the center of a galaxy, and only one of maybe 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. And even more so with Darwin, right? Who basically, his theory of species evolution by natural selection, it didn't have any requirement for God in there, right? The implication being that humans too, our species is kind of an accident of genetic mutation, and that there's really nothing special about being a human being. And one more thing that stands out for me, I mean, not only in biology, but in physics. I'm thinking of the Nobel laureate, Steven Weinberg, who said this, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems to be pointless. Or we could also say, the more it seems to be meaningless. Now, again, that's a story. I'm not totally convinced. I still wonder if there's some kind of evolution of consciousness built into the way that the cosmos and biological evolution develops. But the truth is, I don't know. I don't know for sure. So a lot of this about sort of external sources of meaning, worldview, I don't know. And in a way, I think that's a very important part of our Buddhist practice. But basically what I'm saying is meaning as something we understand as objective, external, just out there, it's become problematical. So where does that leave us? What's the alternative? Well, I think we all know the alternative. We're all more or less familiar with it. The idea that when we lose faith in traditional religious stories, it's not only that, as Weinberg says, the universe is sort of pointless and meaningless, but our own lives too seem to be meaningless. In other words, the alternative seems to be a kind of meaninglessness such that, well, there's still a meaning, but it has to be subjectively generated. That is to say, I have to decide for myself what the meaning of my life is. Of course, in practice, what that usually means is we just go along with what everyone else does, right? We believe what everyone else does. We value what other people do. We want what other people want, and so forth. And of course, this fits in very nicely with what I think today is probably the real religion of the modern world, consumerism, right? It's all about the assumption that to live is to enjoy yourself while you can, as much as you can, as long as you can. I think this is, I guess I'm pointing to this as kind of like the religion of the modern world, because I think this is where, if you, it's not so much that you ask people, but if you sort of just look at the way people behaved, I think this is actually where they find the meaning of their lives. It may be unconscious in the sense of that they wouldn't articulate it that way, but that's the meaning of life for many, many people, even those I think who would maybe go to church on Sunday morning. But how do they live the rest of the week, right? So if we look not outside ourselves, but inside ourselves for meaning, this brings us to something that I often talk about, that the presumption of something self-generated, how to say it here, this lifestyle, this consumerist lifestyle that I just spoke about, it is presupposing a story about ourselves. You know, basically, to a large degree, it means, you know, that we're separate from each other, and therefore my well-being is to a large degree separate from your well-being. And as I've talked about, as a way of understanding something that Buddhism expresses, right? Insofar as we have this understanding of ourselves as separate, built into that, I believe, is a fundamental sense of insecurity or sense of lack, such that we could say that this sense of separate self is haunted or shadowed by the feeling that, you know, something is wrong with me, something is missing, I'm not good enough, my life is good enough. It can take many different versions, but what I'm trying to emphasize here is the idea that when meaning then becomes something subjectively generated, what so often happens is it becomes one of these lack projects where we find ourselves, like so many other people, the meaning of my life becomes getting enough money so that I feel comfortable, I feel secure, or becoming famous enough or powerful enough or whatever. And the tragedy of all of these lack projects is really that they're just symptoms of the fundamental problem, which is the dualistic sense of separation, that there's a sense of inadequacy fundamentally built into that. And doesn't matter how much money I get, it doesn't matter how famous I become, it's never going to be enough to fill up this this sense of lack, right? This void or emptiness at the very core of my being. So that in Buddhist terms, all of these lack projects fundamentally don't solve the problem of dukkha. They never actually make us as happy or as secure as we try to become when we are totally caught up. So when the meaning of my life is getting enough money or becoming famous enough, that as a meaning is dangerous because it doesn't really work. And yet it's so sad to see, of course, that that's what many people are so caught up in. Now, of course, by describing it in this way, I have sort of assumed or accepted an important part of Buddhist teaching. But actually, I think this is something that we don't have to accept on faith, because whether or not, you know, you're a Buddhist, whether you understand it in the way that I talk about it as sort of a problem built into the delusion of separate self, I mean, I think something that we see played out in Buddha's, in people's lives over and over again. And it also, I think, exemplifies the really important teaching about karma, which is to say that, you know, our actions have consequences, often consequences we have no idea at the time. Different ways of filling, of finding meaning in our lives, and different ways of living are going to have different types of consequences. And the point of lack projects is that those consequences aren't very good, that they don't really work, that they don't really make you happy. Okay. So basically what I've argued here is, when we look for meaning, where do we find the meaning of our lives? Saying, well, if you find it out there as something objective or external, there's some problems, you know, we're not sure about that. But if you assume the story that the world is meaningless and that it's just for me to generate it myself, well, that's still, the danger there is that that's still dualistic. There's, if it's, especially if it's built on the delusion of ego, the delusion that I'm separate from you and from everybody else, right? Both of those are dualistic, but it's interesting because in Buddhism, of course, we talk a lot about non-duality. So is there another possibility here? Is there another source, another way of understanding the source of meaning, which I think brings us to another way, a different way of understanding the Buddhist path? So let me approach this third possibility somewhat indirectly. Psychologists and sociologists and even economists have discovered in the last generation or so something that I think is really important, but is rarely sort of, there doesn't seem to be sufficient awareness of it. Basically, what they have discovered, and you know, this is with psychological experiments and surveys and such, what they've discovered is that once people have attained a fairly low, fairly minimal level of income, you know, they have enough food to eat, they have a roof, they have certain basics, but it's fairly low. Once they've achieved that level, which is necessary to feel comfortable and happy, but after that, more money, more consumerism doesn't make us happier. In fact, what they find out is the most important constituent of happiness is, in other words, what makes us most happy is the quality of our relationships with other people. And what I find fascinating about this is that, you know, this is not a religious claim. This is not a spiritual claim. This is something that they claim is a result of studies. And yet, so it's an empirical fact and incredibly important. I mean, it seems to me like, why isn't this taught in every elementary and middle school? Is it the most important psychological or scientific discovery of all time? And of course, it's very consistent with what Buddhism claims, that we're not separate from each other. One important characteristic, apparently unique to our species, is that we can develop the ability to disidentify from anything and from everything. Letting go, as happens in meditation, letting go not only of our individual sense of self, but also letting go of the collective selves that we so often identify with, right? In other words, through meditation, particularly in Buddhism, that's the form that Buddhism meditation is, right? What Buddhism emphasizes. Buddhism can help us dissociate, let go of our maybe largely unconscious identification with patriarchy, right? I'm a man, not a woman, and men are better than women, or men need to control women, whatever. It can enable us to dissociate ourselves from nationalism, right? I'm American, not Chinese. Racism, I'm white, I'm not black. And this is especially important today, I think, it can help us dissociate from speciesism, right? I'm human, I'm not a lower animal, right? Meditation is one of the reasons it's so very important is that it can help us with this kind of dissociation. But the point of this letting go, of course, is not to dissociate from everything, but in a way, just the opposite. By not taking sides, this side rather than that side, in a way, we open up and become receptive to both, right? By not identifying with either, we can come to sort of identify with everything. And this is one meaning of non-duality. But if it's the case that we are interdependent with others, in fact, we could say non-dual with the rest of the world, then I think this means that meaning, understand the meaning of our lives. I think meaning too can arise and develop in a non-dual way. Deeper than ego. I'm thinking of the old word calling, having a calling. You know, conventionally in the past, people would talk about having, well, if you think of often like great artists, a Picasso or a poet like Rilke, I mean, from a very early age, they knew what they wanted to do. They feel called upon. It's like called upon by something deeper than their ego. The whole point being, it wasn't simply a matter of kind of ego, this is what I want to do, but there is a sense of being connected with something greater or deeper than ego that's calling to them, that's calling them to respond in a particular kind of way. And I think that this isn't just something for great poets and painters, but I think, in fact, this is something that is a very important part of the Buddhist path. To give one example, I've been talking a lot over the last year or two about eco-dharma, right? About the eco-sattva path. And, you know, often people ask me, they want to be more active ecologically, but they're not sure what they should do. And how do they decide? And what I've started to talk about sometimes, and some people do seem to find it helpful, is a kind of three-part meditation that can help people get in touch with something deeper. Starting out with by asking yourself, you know, what do I have to offer? What, you know, taking account of the specifics of my age, health, gender, education, training, networks, and so forth. What do I have to offer? Secondly, what are the possibilities? What are the needs? How I might be engaged? But the third contemplation or meditation is the one that really speaks to this looking for something deeper than ego. Having digested those first two, looking inside, looking outside, having digested those, this bringing this questioning deep within ourselves, you know, what tugs at my heart? What do I feel called upon? What's calling to me? How does my love, how does my compassion want to express itself? I think that's an example of what I'm trying to point to here, that meaning doesn't simply have to be a kind of ego decision, but if we really can meditate on it, open up to the deeper parts of ourselves, that which goes beyond our usual sense of self, maybe, you know, you might call it the unconscious, whatever. But if we can really open up to that, which in a way that's what we're doing when we're meditating, then we can get a sense of something flowing through us, that something draws to us, something is calling to us. And that, I would say, is a really non-dual way of understanding meaning, of understanding the meaning of my life. It's not about simply fitting in with some external, nor is it simply subjectively generated, but something deeper that incorporates and goes beyond both of those. So frankly, I think this is the heart. This is really the heart of the kind of meaning project that Buddhism can offer us, right? It's like, okay, the truth is, I don't know about whether the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, was the sixth Buddha, right? I don't know about some of the details of Buddhist cosmology. And by saying I don't know, it's not that I reject them. It's just that I really don't know. I put them on the shelf, but in a way, that's not the really the most important thing. Because whether we buy into the details of that system, Buddhism offers us a meaning, a story, an essential story, a basic story that addresses our happiness or unhappiness, our dukkha, dissatisfaction, right here and now, right? Basically what it's saying, that a life devoted to trying to satisfy our desires doesn't work. Okay, that's the first two of the four noble truths. That living in that way reinforces the dualistic and delusive sense of separation. And what goes along with that then is the kind of profound irony is that the way to become happy, the way to, you know, the way to feel fulfilled is to actually forget ourselves, to over forget in the sense of overcome our usual self preoccupation and focus on what we can offer to others. And that, according to the Buddhist story, whatever meaning may arise non-dually in the way that I've talking about, it'll be connected in some way with how, what can we do to make the world a better place for all of us, and indeed for everyone. Indeed, today we have to emphasize for the earth itself. I recently came across a quotation from Winston Churchill. We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give. And this reminds me of another favorite quotation that I've been using a lot lately by Franz Kafka, who said, "You can hold yourself back from the sufferings of the world. You can do that. You can live in that way. But perhaps that holding back is the one suffering that you could have avoided." Why? Because holding back in that way reinforces the sense of separation, reinforces the delusion that my well-being is separate from your well-being. And according to, you know, this understanding of the heart of the path, this, this is at the heart of our dukkha. This sense of separation is sort of, in a way, the most fundamental, the most heartbreaking, the most problematical dukkha. Shantideva, very important figure in Tibetan Buddhism. Ninth century, he wrote The Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. He put it very beautifully. He said, "All the suffering in the world comes from wishing ourselves to be happy. All the joy in the world comes from wishing others to be happy." Hence his great prayer, "For as long as space and time endure, may I remain to work for the benefit of living beings." Remain in the sense, in the conventional Buddhist sense, may I continue to reborn. As the Dalai Lama himself says, may I, you know, his desire to be reborn is to continue working for the benefit of all living beings. There's a short poem by, actually, I don't know if he's Korean or Chinese, Wu Cho, but I love it. It's like, it's almost like a haiku. "There is no secret teaching, no pure land, only this dirty old universe with its endless opportunities to be kind. Only this dirty old universe with its endless opportunities to be kind. And of course, the Buddha himself in the Pali Canon, you know, he's talking about this too, in the Metta Sutra in particular, right? Again, whatever living beings there be, feeble or strong, long, stout or medium, seen or unseen, dwelling far or near, may all beings be happy, just as a mother would protect her only child, even at the risk of her own life. Even so, let one cultivate a boundless heart toward all beings. Let one's thoughts of boundless love pervade the whole world, above, below, and across, without any obstruction, without any hatred, without any enmity. So in a way, what we're saying something here, this is all saying something that we've heard many times before, that in a way, the deepest meaning, the most powerful and the most fulfilling has something to do with this word we call love. Something we've all heard a lot about before. I'm quite fond of quoting the Neo-Vedantin Nisargadatta, who said, "When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love." Or as we would say in Buddhism, the word we would usually use is something like compassion, right? Wisdom, compassion, the two pillars of the Buddhist path. And to say it again, what I love about this way of putting it is that it shows the relationship between them. The wisdom of realizing non-duality, non-separation, and how do we embody it? It's one thing to realize that. How do we live according to what that implies? And that would be a life of love, a life of compassion. Now, to be clear here, I don't think that we are required to live this way, right? This is maybe where I have my questions about some of the objectivity of some of these meaning systems. In a way, it's important, I think, to realize that we are free. We are free to live the way we want. We are free to choose the story we want. But here's where karma comes in. The point is that our decisions, our actions, the meanings that we live by, the story that we live by, those actions, they have consequences. And, you know, selfish stories have problematical, they tend to have problematical consequences and so forth. So quite apart from whether a lot of the details of the Buddhist cosmology are true, I think this really goes to the heart of it, the realization that, yes, what we do, the meaning that we find for our lives, and the actions that we take according to those stories, they have consequences. And it's important on this path to realize how to see the relationship between certain types of stories and certain consequences, and in particular, connect that, as I said, with the delusion of a separate self and the dukkha, the suffering built into that sense of separation. By living in this way, I think we contribute to, or maybe we can say we participate in, making this world into the kind of world that we would want to live in. Whether or not Steven Weinberg what he says is true or not, I guess maybe we can understand humans. Maybe what it means to be human is that we are how the cosmos, we are how the universe creates meaning. It's said that we're created in the image of God, according to the Bible, which is kind of peculiar if you think about it. So God has a nose? Or is it more metaphorical in the sense that if God is a metaphor here, a symbol for the fundamental creative process that, you know, the universe is itself the creative process, and we are part of that process, and we become epicenters, we become manifestations of this creative process. And by living in these kinds of ways, by having this understanding, by having this kind of story and non-dual story and living according to it, are we not just changing our own lives, but in some fundamental way, you know, changing the very world that we live in? Is this how the universe evolves? I don't know. So anyway, to sum up, I've raised questions about whether meaning is, should be, can be understood as objective, external out here. And I've also asked some questions about, or said that there's some problematical things about if we simply understand meaning as simply some kind of subjective creation, right? That the world is meaningless and I'm free to sort of find any meaning that I want. I think the two essentials of Buddhism that I always keep coming back to are, well, one of them is this meaning can arise non-dually in the way that I've talked about, but also that our different meaning projects have different consequences, which is, and understanding those consequences is getting at the heart of the Buddhist teaching. Please note that everything I've said here, nothing really talks about, or this understanding that I've tried to offer this evening doesn't require or assume, you know, like there's some kind of post-mortem survival of something, right? Again, this is something, you know, what Buddhism says about cosmological karma and rebirth, physical rebirth, I don't know. I really don't know. And it's not I reject it, it's just that In a way, that's not the important point. I put it on a shelf. The important point is, if I live the best way I can now, according to what we've talked about, then after I die, that will take care of itself, right? But also, maybe just to add one final thought here, maybe if we live in this way, maybe the importance of post-mortem survival, the importance of some kind of immortality, maybe is that something that we can outgrow the need for? Can it be sufficient to put that possibility on a shelf and say, we don't know? And that's okay. You know, our task is to respond appropriately here and now in a loving way that acknowledges our non-duality with other people. And the particular ways that expresses itself, of course, will be different for different people, but it'll involve something deeper than just kind of ego decision. I think I'll leave it at that for the moment then. I hope that made some sense. It's certainly a very different type of Dharma talk, if you want to call it a Dharma talk, but those reflections have been sort of going around in my mind for a while. So let me leave it at that. Thank you for your attention.